From Local 12 Sports, it's the Skinny Podcast. Now, here's Richard Skinner.
Welcome into the Skinny Podcast, the weekly potpourri edition. I'm Richard Skinner, Local12.com digital sports columnist and editor with Rick Roaring. As always, it's presented by Blake the Attorney Mason. We got a lot to get to. We're going to touch a little bit on NFL draft stuff, but we're going to have a full-fledged draft show next week, doing it the day before the draft. So if anybody's wondering why we didn't touch on a lot of draft talk today, it's because we're going to do that next week. But we got a lot of stuff to get to, Rick, and I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, we'll lead off with the Reds here today. The Reds are sitting at 9-9 on their off day here Thursday as we record this. Since we last spoke, they swept the White Sox and then got swept by the Mariners. They mustered just one hit in the loss on Wednesday to the Mariners. Skinny, we'll start with, are you worried after the Reds' three-game losing skid in Seattle and the way the offense looked?
No, it's disappointing. I mean, because that sweep, you would have thought there'd be some momentum to at least take a game from Seattle. But no, again, you're still missing two key cogs in your lineup. Last night, you were missing Wednesday afternoon, you were missing Christian Encarnacion Strain out of the lineup. And I think it just touches on a depth issue to some degree. And look, sometimes groups go in funks, and the group's in a funk at the moment. I think one thing to take note of is the funk that Jonathan India is in. And I go back. I was listening to our friend Lance McAllister, and I actually texted him last night this, and he texted me a stat back. And I said he was bringing up Jonathan's struggles. And again, if your leadoff guy's struggling, that's going to kind of set the tone for your whole offense. And I didn't have the stats in front of me. I just knew it looked like he's been in a funk since he got hit in the hand that one day, that Sunday against whoever the heck it was a couple Sundays ago. And he texted me back. I think he said he's 2-for-30 since then.
Wow.
And, you know, maybe that's working on him mentally. Maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't know, but he doesn't look like the same guy at the plate at the moment. And, you know, yesterday he took three called third strikes. Something's up there. The problem is now you're down to, if he's not in the lineup, it's Santiago Espinal, or you're going to have to consider moving Spencer Steer from left field to second base and just rolling with an extra left-handed bat in the outfield for the time being and go with that.
Yeah, and by the way, yesterday Espinal was in the lineup with him.
Right.
You didn't even have that option. A lot of fans were really wringing their hands after this loss, and I get it. Baseball season, it is kind of about the roller coaster, the ups and the downs, and people kind of live and die with each series. And when you get swept like this and you get one hit in the final game of the series, fans are going to be frustrated. So I understand you shouldn't read too much into that, but I was a little bit surprised how down on this team that people already are, because I think when we did the show the first week of the season, we were talking about what to expect here. I was really worried about, with the injuries they were facing, having Friedel out, having McClain out, some of the injury things in the pitching staff that they were trying to figure out as they started the season, Lodolo not being there right away. I was worried that we were going to get off to a 4-20 start or something like that, Skinny. You know, I mean, like, I thought it could be an absolute disaster, and we laugh, but that's the way it's been the last few seasons with this team. They have been in terrible shape by the end of April, typically. So this fact that they're sitting at 500, look, I'm not thrilled about the way the Mariners series went, but I didn't sign up for India leading off, Fairchild batting third, Nick Martini as the DH, and Santiago Espinal starting at third base. And that's what they were doing yesterday when they got one hit in Seattle. So I guess the other part of that is, how many times have we seen the Reds go out to the West Coast and put up a three-game stinker of a series?
Right.
Like, that's not – I've been watching the Reds long enough to know that just be numb to that. That's not uncommon at all.
Yeah, no, again, I get that some fans have a hard time with the roller coaster of a baseball season, but you can't get overreactionary on one series. I mean, you can do it maybe for a month and take stock there. That's why I take stock on Memorial Day. That's the first time I start to take stock. And that's where you kind of go, okay, in or out, what else needs to be done here? And then take stock again at the All-Star break and see where you're at as far as the trade deadline goes. Again, I get it. It's frustrating. Yesterday is totally frustrating because they got one hit, but at the end of the day, it's hard. I think the fear for some fans is, if you don't get out of this month above 500, next month is a gauntlet. I mean, there's no question about it. I was just pulling it up. You know, you got a series with the Orioles, two series with the Diamondbacks home and away, a series at the Dodgers, a series at the Giants, a series at the Padres, or no, a series at home against the Padres, the Dodgers at home. I mean, May is a gauntlet, man. And so I get the frustration of where you think this team needs to be at the end of April.
But overall, I mean, obviously the last three games were terrible, but overall they're sitting at 9-9. I know you don't want to take stock just yet, but are you on the same wavelength of me as, like, I'm kind of okay with the 9-9 right now. I'd like it to be better, but I thought it could be worse potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and there have been certainly some bright spots. You know, I think you're seeing, you know, an Andrew Abbott who hit the wall last year. I think that's all it was, the last few starts. If you parse the last few starts out, you go, which is that really him, or was it the guy who had 18 to 20 good starts before that? No, I think he just hit a wall. And I think
on that note, are you buying stock in Andrew Abbott after his first four starts? He has the best ERA on the team at 2.70.
I always have. I think he, Ashcraft, Lodolo are the heart of this rotation. And I noticed I didn't say Hunter Green because I still need to be shown. And again, he had one of those Hunter Green-like starts the other night. You know, my boss did a nice short story that on a record that he actually set for the most strikeouts in the first 50 starts in Reds history. And they've had some fireballers. Mario Soto was a strikeout guy. Jim Maloney was a strikeout guy. Young Gary Nolan, those are the guys behind him. Young Gary Nolan was a fireballer back in the late 60s, early 70s. So he blew his arm out and then had to change the way he pitched. It was a big factor in the 75 and 76 teams. But, I mean, that speaks to the stuff he's got. It also then speaks to he only could get through four innings. And so I get that frustration level with him too. But I think Abbott, Ashcraft, and Lodolo, when healthy, they are the heart and soul of this rotation moving forward.
Yeah, I think starting pitching has been one of the bright spots for this team as we've kind of watched the offense struggle through this initial month of the season, not even quite a month yet. But you mentioned Abbott, and Lodolo made his return start this past weekend, went 5 2/3 innings, gave up one hit, no runs, one walk, 10 strikeouts. It was a fantastic first outing of the season for him and return outing from his injury from last year. What are kind of the thoughts of the pitching staff right now? Because like you said, I mean, Green isn't actually pitching his best yet. He's been a little up and down. But aside from that, I feel like overall the starting pitching has been better than expected.
Yeah, I asked somebody who covers the team this week about Frankie Montas. And I said, do you think he's hurt again? And he said, no, I just think he's kind of hit a little bit of a wall here to start and he'll get through it. But the start the other night was a little concerning for him because it took him a lot of pitches just to get through the first. Looked like he was going to survive if he got through a nice second, and then all of a sudden the wheels fall off again. You know, he had the first two good starts, now a couple of shaky starts. He's your number one in your rotation at the moment for a reason. But I think the starting pitching overall has been very good for the most part.
Yeah, and the thing with Montas, as we've talked about since the beginning of the season, if he was going to be your best pitcher this year, that wasn't a great situation.
No, great point. Yeah, great point. And again, I think we always assume that the guy who's the opening day starter is supposed to be what you consider your staff ace. Truth be told, he's not. I mean, I think from a stuff perspective, I've always thought Nick Lodolo is, and I think he's going to prove that. And then, you know, the way Ashcraft has pitched for the most part and the way Abbott's pitched for the most part are very solid.
You know, it's funny revisiting the opening day starter conversation that we had before the season now between, you know, Montas getting it over Hunter Green. And I said at the time, like, if Montas is your best pitcher, that's not good for this rotation. This feels a lot more like they're dangling a carrot for Hunter Green.
Yeah.
And now that we've seen the way Hunter Green has started the season, it feels like that's probably exactly what it was. He is just not ready to be the ace of a staff. He hasn't proven that yet. So in their minds, they're probably thinking, we need to make sure he understands that he is not the top dog of this rotation. We still need more out of him.
Yeah, there's no question. They do need more out of him. I mean, it's 50 starts in now. It's time to get things going.
Final thoughts. Any other thoughts? Anything we didn't get to on the Reds, Skinny?
No. The one thing I would say is, and I know we always fuss about lineup construction, I do find managers interesting to me. Like leaving Jamer Candelario in cleanup spot for so long, now leaving Jonathan Indy at the top of the order. It's okay to move guys out of spots if they're struggling. I'm not talking about a two-day stretch, but when you're 2 for 30 some odd, that suggests it's probably not the guy to lead off at the moment.
I would tend to agree with you there. All right, let's move on to college basketball. And we'll start with this, Skinny. We talked about it so much. We did an emergency podcast on it. So we'll put the bow on this story. And that is Mark Pope being hired as the new head coach at Kentucky. Did you get to see the introductory press conference?
No, I saw clips of it later. I was actually doing public address at a Reds Youth Academy softball games on Sunday. So I missed it, but I've seen clips of it.
Okay, and I'm sure you have seen the introduction, how they came into the arena. We have the video here for those of you watching on YouTube. But there it is as they come in on the UK bus, the 1996 national champion team. And Pope comes off last, carrying the championship trophy. Skinny, this got the UK fans fired up, and understandably so. Pretty nice touch here by Mark Pope to start the press conference, right?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. You know, the crowd did its part by showing up, 20,000 plus. I heard a guy call KSR on Monday with tears talking about going to the event. I mean, for whatever needed to happen, it was funny because, you know, Friday we did the emergency podcast. I'm sure there was some negative reaction to me liking the hire. There was a lot of negative reaction on social media about Mark Pope. And it flipped in about a 48-hour span to, this is our guy.
What did I tell you when we did the podcast? Yep. Everyone wins the press conference now. Fans just want to have emotional reactions. They don't actually care what's happening. Now, that being said, I thought Mark Pope's press conference was fantastic.
Yes.
The introduction, coming in on the bus with the other champions, the making it all about Kentucky. I mean, when he's talking about playing for the jersey, the name on the front of the jersey, and when he's talking about he hit on all the notes, all the things that people disliked about Calipari, the scheduling, all of those things. He made sure to call those out in his press conference. He's a sharp guy. I think he's a little goofy at times. I think there may be a cringy thing or two that he does to try to get on social media and get the fan base going. He's not going to be as cool as Cal was, but he is a sharp, smart guy who fully understands this fan base. From the PR perspective, they are absolutely fine with Mark Pope.
Yes, until he falls behind 22-14 in Rupp Arena for the first time.
Yeah, right. And that's what it always comes down to with all of these guys. I mean, Pat Kelsey is the same way at Louisville. All these guys win the press conference now because fans just want a social media video to get hyped about. Once you put that out there, they love you. That's all you need to do for the first 6 months of your job.
No question. Build a roster, though. That's the next point of order.
And he's got a lot of work to do there because, as far as I know, Kentucky still has not added anybody in the transfer portal. Obviously, there are some guys that are figuring out what they're going to do next, whether they enter the portal, whether they go to the NBA, or whether they come back. So we'll keep an eye on that. But Zvonimir Ivicic did transfer out. He is already committed to Arkansas. Aaron Bradshaw has transferred out. He is already committed to Ohio State. Also, Adu Thierro, Joey Hart, and DJ Wagner are all in the portal. And as I mentioned, none of the other UK players, UK has not added any other players out of the portal yet.
Yeah, the Wagner one's interesting to me because I would assume he's going to put his name in the NBA draft, right?
I would think so. Yeah, I mean, it would be shocking if he didn't at least test the waters there. Yeah. But, I mean, most guys, when they decide to go into the portal, they usually say, I'm testing the NBA draft and entering the portal. So, I don't believe he did that.
So Reed Shepherd hasn't done anything yet, but it does seem like it's trending more and more to he's going to hop into the NBA and take the lottery money, yes?
You would think he has to, but I think Kentucky did everything they possibly could to entice him to come back by hiring Mark Pope. That was probably the only way it was going to work out, is hire a guy who played with his dad's friends with his dad, who's really going to get the entire UK fan base excited about old school Kentucky hoops. Reed Shepherd seems like kind of the name that everyone wants to be the face of the program for that next year. I don't think it's going to happen, but I feel like there's still an outside chance.
I do too. But, and the lottery money is just so hard to say no to, right? And there's no guarantee. Although, again, I don't think if he comes back, he's going backwards in his NBA draft stock. Now, some guys may leapfrog him in next year's class. I have no idea what that class even looks like. Hell, none of us do, because it is what it is. But I don't think he drops fully a ton back. In fact, I think he's got a chance to even show more. But I get it, man. If that lottery money's there, it is really hard to say, yeah, I'm good with my seven-figure NIL deal at 1.2 mil over the X number of mil, you know, double-digit lottery deal that I can get. So it's hard.
That's the thing. It is so different now, though. The math used to say there is no question, there is no conversation about it. You just go into the lottery. But now, if you can make $1.5 million potentially, which I don't think is out of the question for a guy like Reed Shepherd playing at Kentucky, maybe you do consider staying in one more year and living up the college lifestyle. Because I fully believe this. Reed Shepherd probably will never have a more fun year in his life than he would if he stayed at Kentucky for one more year, made $1.5 million as a college athlete, was the star of college basketball. I mean, it would be an incredibly fun year, and you're still making $1.5 million to do it. I don't think that can be considered a bad decision at this point, or a silly decision with your money, a bad money decision, to make $1.5 million and have one of the best experiences of your life.
No, I'm with you on that regard. But again, whatever decision he makes, even if he opts to go, if you're a Kentucky fan, it's hard to begrudge it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong if you're Reed Shepherd. That's
right,
the great news.
Right.
Cincinnati, Skinny, they have added a couple of big names this week in the transfer portal. They got Bradley guard Connor Hickman, who actually played against them in the NIT game, put 14 points up against them, which seems to be Wes Miller's favorite method of recruiting. If they play well against us in the NIT, we're going to go recruit him for next year. And then he also added USC big man Arrington Page, who was a guy that they were a finalist for before he committed to USC last year as a freshman. Played this year at USC, came off the bench. He's 6'10", 6'11"-ish athletic big man. Didn't put up big numbers, but again, he's a freshman coming off the bench for USC. He'll be added to the mix, added to the front court to go along with Asis Bandego. They also lost Victor Lockin. He entered the portal, and he has committed to Clemson already.
Yeah, well, let me start with that last one there, the Victor Lockin to Clemson. If things didn't work out for him playing against Big 12 bigs, how's it going to work out playing against ACC bigs? I don't get it.
I think the only thought
change
there,
of scenery?
I think that's exactly what it is. I think the only thought there by Clemson's coaching staff is that something went wrong between Victor Lockin and the coaching staff. He fell out of favor, and if you use him differently and play him more and get him back on the right mindset, he can be effective. But I'm with you. We called it out before the season last year that he probably wasn't going to be as effective against Big 12 level big men as he was in the AAC. They tried to keep putting him in there at the starting forward spot, and it never worked out playing the two bigs together. And by the end of the season, they found him to be unplayable. So if I was a Clemson fan, I would not be excited about this addition. I think he probably could have found a better level transferring down a little bit.
Yeah, the kid from Bradley is interesting. I can't remember who tweeted it out, but I guess he quoted Brian Wardle, the coach who used to be at Green Bay, right? If I'm not mistaken, as saying, as soon as he got in there and saw the facilities, he knew he was losing that kid. He knew he was losing that kid to UC, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, Connor is a 40% 3-point shooter. He's like 6'3"-ish, so it kind of feels a little bit like he's going to fulfill the role that they thought CJ Frederick would play last year for them as that wing shooter scorer on the offensive end. CJ, because of his injuries, never was able to get going in that role. I assume that's the thought process here, is maybe Hickman will be that type of guy. And you still have CJ backing him up.
Yeah, in theory.
In theory, right. And then Xavier added Oklahoma big man John Hughley. Also, they already had Furman wing Marcus Foster. We talked about him a week or so ago. And Lazar Djokovic, they have seven players in the portal. We've talked about all those guys. Lazar Djokovic did commit to College of Charleston. He'll be playing for Chris Mack. So two of the three Xavier transfers that have committed somewhere already are going to be playing for former Xavier coaches. Cam Kraft is at Miami with Travis Steele. Yep. Lazar Djokovic at College of Charleston with Chris Mack.
And let me ask you about Marquez Warrick, who committed to Missouri yesterday. I wish him well. I understand why he wants to take that step up. And maybe I'm going to be wrong, and I hope I am for his sake. Because he's not a pure shooter. He's a scorer. Big difference between the two. He can shoot it, but he's not a pure shooter. I think you'd agree with that part. Yep. He's a scorer. Yep. I just think scoring against SEC guards for him will be tough.
I think that's going to be tough for him. The biggest disappointment here is, as an NKU fan, this guy meant so much to your program. The thought was, go on, get your opportunity to play for a bigger, better level and do bigger, better things. We'll see you in the NCAA tournament. That'll be so much fun. And now he's going to a program that's in shambles, that didn't win a single SEC game last year, that has a coach that's on the hot seat. We've already seen that coach at the Horizon League level. He wasn't any better at coaching than what you're already getting coached by in the Horizon League. That's the frustrating part for me. It's not a better spot for him.
And that's where I'd be honest with you. Again, I don't want to besmirch Marquez because he's
awesome. Yeah.
He's great. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But I think this shows you, for Dennis Gates, who's the coach there, and as you mentioned, he coached in the Horizon League, if that's the level of talent you're bringing in the portal, I don't know if you're upgrading your team a ton to compete in that league.
I would agree with that. It's probably – I love Marquez. I wouldn't bet against the kid because he's proved people wrong every time people said he couldn't do it. So it wouldn't surprise me if he goes in and has a good year for Missouri. But Missouri was a disaster last season, and I just don't think that they're going to be able to turn it around this quickly with Dennis Gates at the helm. So, I mean, look, Marquez clearly believes in the situation he's going to. I hope it works out for him. Good for him. I'm happy for him. I am frustrated from a fan's perspective that I was hoping to see him play in the NCAA tournament next year, play on a good team, play in a system that really fits him well. We'll see if that's Missouri, but I don't feel good about it going in.
Yeah.
Also, NKU added a Division II point guard, transfer Daniel Gerziger, I believe is how you say it. He's from Michigan Tech. This is a guy, Skinny, if you look at each of the last two seasons, they had Xavier Rhodes from the Division II level on 1 year. He was great. Then they had Michael Bradley from the Division II level for 1 year. He was great. The thing about Gerziger is he has 2 years, so they'll actually be able to build with him a little bit. And he's kind of like a mix between Rhodes and Bradley. Rhodes was an athlete, had a little more length, but didn't maybe necessarily have the IQ and feel. And then Bradley was kind of the opposite, didn't have the athleticism or the size and length, but he really did have the feel and maturity. I think this new guy is kind of a combination of the two. He's 6'4". He's more athletic than either of them. He can break you down with some crossovers, but he also seems to have some real feel with running the offense and setting the table for his teammates. So this feels like an excellent get for the Norse based on their recent track record.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a pretty good length. I mean, he's 6'4", Sam Vincent's 6'5", Trey Robinson's 6'6", 6'7"-ish.
LJ Wells is 6'7".
Yeah.
You know, TJ 6'9".
That's really good length for that league.
Really good length. And it's something that Darren Horn has talked about relentlessly since he got here. It's like, look, we've had great players. Drew McDonald, which I didn't even get to coach, was, you know, one of the best mid-major players you'll ever see. But there is something too when you get to the NCAA tournament, you play a Kentucky or a Houston, or you're in the NIT and you play Louisville, all of a sudden your mid-major players that look like mid-major players have some trouble against those types of athletes. And NKU has been trying to ramp it up year after year, getting to that level of length and athleticism. And it feels like this is the first year that they really might be kind of at that almost high major looking type of team.
Yeah. And how much better could that matchup zone be with that kind of length too, right?
It's got me excited. That's for sure. I love the length and athleticism of this year's group. And I mean, you just look across college basketball, how many teams are bringing back four starters plus two other guys who played significant minutes. I mean, the main core, I mean, don't get me wrong, losing your all-time leading scorer is big in Marquess Warrick, but they have a nice core coming back here. Skinny, one of the conversations on my musketeerreport.com message board this week has been about the differences now for college coaches between like recruiting high school recruits and the way it always used to go, this slow grind all across the year. Then you get to the spring and summer months and you're at all these AAU tournaments. And we're talking about these guys on a timeline of like 4 or 5 months, maybe they'll make their decision. Now everything is condensed to all the focus is on a 45-day transfer portal period. You rebuild your roster through that. You're almost pushing the freshmen to the side and saying they're an afterthought now. Who really cares what we do in the preps recruiting scene? What are your thoughts on this? Like, how do you think this is going? Does it interest you more? Does it interest you less? Where are you at?
Well, it interests me more, I guess, to some degree because it's names I know. I don't follow college. I never really was a big follow college recruiting guy other than big names at the top. So you follow it more. Certainly our friend Chad Brendel follows it more. I don't. I just never have been in that niche of it. So these are guys whose names I know. So I guess in that regard, it does interest me more. But to your point, and this is where you're never not going to recruit hard for kids coming out of high school because they have to. You have to have a roster and you're not going to have all portal guys on your roster. But does this take you as a coach away from trying to get that one and done NBA level guy that you really have to grind to get and say, you know, I'm only going to have him for a year anyway. So what difference does it make? I'd rather have a guy the notch below that with my portal guys and try to build. I think one guy who's done a really good job with that is Matt Painter. I mean, I really do. I think he's found a nice little secret sauce there of getting some high school guys that are going to stay for a few years. And then mixing a portal guy in there. I mean, he had the one kid who started at forward this year was a portal guy, but the rest of his guys were guys in the program already. So I think he's found a little bit of a secret sauce. You can argue he hasn't won a national championship. His program's rolling pretty well. I think we can all agree with that.
He almost didn't change his strategy. It felt like he was kind of like, I'm just not going to bother with the portal and all this stuff. I mean, like you said, they went out and got a guy, and you always do. Everyone's been taking a transfer here and there for you know, decades. But it does seem like he's mostly stuck to, like, we've got our Purdue-type kids, and we'll make them better and develop them throughout their career. But I'm of the opinion that if you look at what Kentucky did, for instance, this year, where you landed – pretty much any top recruit that you wanted. You had all the top freshmen on the team.
And individually, they were really good.
They were really talented. And
some were less consistent than others, but they were talented kids.
And look where it got them, playing against 22 and 23-year-olds. I think that's the issue. It's not about the lack of talent. And if you still have bona fide NBA stars, if you have an Anthony Davis and a Michael Kidd-Gilchrist on your team, that's still going to help you. I mean, look at UConn. They had Donovan Klingon and Caravan, a sophomore who they recruited, and also bringing in Stephon Castle. They had three guys that they recruited themselves that were, you know, they would be stars on any team. They were like sort of sharing the limelight on their team because they had so many of them. I think that is still a good way to get the top tier talent on your team is
but they don't win it without that transfer portal backcourt.
Exactly right. And so it's a blending process. And I think you have to have the age and experience now to win a championship. You're not going to go in there with a couple of one and done guys and then whoever around them and win significantly.
Okay, so here's the other question, and it could flip again on its ear here in the next couple of years, because some of these guys who are older were COVID year guys, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to drop off here eventually. So do we get now to where it's not 23 and 24-year-old dudes? It's back to, and again, 22 versus a 19-year-old can certainly be different maturation process, but not as big of a gap maybe as 24, 25-year-old guy playing college basketball still. So does that flip back at some point?
I think it has to, just from a math standpoint. It feels like all these coaches this year are taking like one freshman, no freshman, two freshmen, and then they've got 4 1-year guys that they're taking as trans. At some point, if you're all relying on transfers, who populates the transfer portal? Like where do those guys come from? I have to think the D2 ranks are going to be filled with talented dudes over the next several years.
Good point.
If I'm a mid-major school, or even not any school right now in the Division I ranks, I am mining the hell out of the D2 transfer portal, because there has got to be guys slipping through the cracks right now with the way Division I coaches are handling their recruiting process, strictly looking at the portal.
Yeah, no doubt. It will be fascinating to watch, but for right now, like I said, I'm of that ilk of, you know, again, if there's an NBA talent that you can get that you didn't have to completely grind to get, well, you're not going to say no to that, for goodness sakes. But if you're just grinding on this dude, and you're one of the 5 schools he's considering, and it cost you a chance to look elsewhere, then I would say I'd rather take it down a notch and get me some portal guys and let's go.
Yeah, I just think also from the fans' perspective, when you're trying to follow this stuff, like for someone who would be interested in my site, for instance, I think it's really hard to get into a high school kid you know nothing about, you know nothing about his competition, and he may be able to help you in 2 years, versus the guy in the portal who you know his stats against Division I competition. Maybe it was at a lower level last year, but maybe not. And he's going to play for you right away. Now, he may not be good enough, as we saw last year in some cases, but he's going to play right away and make an instant impact and dictate whether or not your team is good this year. To me, that's much more fascinating. It feels a lot more like NFL and NBA free agency, which is hugely popular.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not asking anybody to feel sorry for coaches. I will say from a coaching perspective, though, to have to reteach everything each year would be the grind. You know, as a freshman high school coach, I had to do that every year with new players. When I coached AAU, the good part about that was I had basically the same core, and all we were doing was refining stuff and not having to reteach. This is the way I want this done, this done, this done. You got to do that every daggone year now with a whole roster almost.
That would be hard, but they practice so damn much.
They do that. That's a fair point.
That I don't feel as bad about that. The one thing that I do think is just absolutely brutal, and this is coming up time and time again when I've been on the phone the last several days with coaches, they're all like, I'm done with this. I'm quitting. This business sucks. I'm out of it. And you know why? Because they went from finishing their entire season where they're all burnt out, they're all at their wits' end, they're all ready to go to sleep and rest and have some relaxation, and they entered the transfer portal season for the next 45 days, which is the most stressful, absurd, ridiculous part of their sport.
Well, because you're also playing the juggling act of, okay, I got 3 guys coming in. Do I have 3 guys going out, or do I have 2 going out, or maybe only 1's going out? You're playing a juggling act with that as well.
You've got parents, you've got agents, you've got kids who didn't do anything for you last year coming in asking for a $75,000 to $100,000 raise. I mean, it's like the absurdity of the situation is so stressful to these guys, and I understand that part of it.
So here's a question for you, Rick, and I don't know if there's a clear – there probably isn't. Would it behoove everybody to change the portal to maybe make it May? And to your point, let everybody just kind of have
– a breather?
Yeah.
Probably from that standpoint, from the rest and relaxation and the not being like crazy human standpoint. But I think logistically it's going to create other problems. I mean, these guys will be back into their workout sessions and stuff here in like a month.
Yeah, so what's your point? Yeah.
I just don't know that there's really enough time for that. They've got to figure out where they're going to school next year, if they're moving. Like, I think logistically it just doesn't work out if you have a big gap there. So I don't know how you fix it, but I know it is definitely making some people lose their minds, especially those that are in like that GM position,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
All right, Skinny, let's move on to the Bengals. The Bengals have the 6th easiest schedule for next season based on projected win totals, according to Sharp Football Analysts. Meanwhile, the Steelers, Browns, and Ravens are projected to have 3 of the 5 most difficult schedules next season. The Bengals will host the following teams: Ravens, Steelers, Browns, Broncos, Raiders, Eagles, Commanders, and Patriots. They'll travel to Dallas, Kansas City, Los Angeles for the Chargers, New York for the Giants, Carolina, Tennessee, Cleveland, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh. Do you think that's a big deal for the Bengals to have one of the six weakest schedules next season compared to the rest of their division?
Yeah, I mean, the silver lining of finishing last is you get a last place schedule in some places. Now, listen, most of your opponents are set, but a couple of those crossover games are literally you're playing a like finisher from another division. That's how they got Tennessee on the schedule this year, for goodness sake. So, yeah, I mean, it can't hurt for sure. And I think that's something that you need. That's probably, I'm glad you brought it up because it's probably not been talked about, thought about enough. But I think it is a plus. You know, again, it sucks to go to a Super Bowl and AFC championship game and then not make the playoffs. But they also finished with a winning record, and that winning record still got them in last place. So you got the last place portion of the schedule. I saw the athletic.com today did a story ranking the rosters 1 to 32 in the NFL, and it had the Bengals as the 10th best roster. And I thought that was probably about right. It said, other than quarterback and wide receiver, they don't really have an elite position group. But they're also, aside from running back and tight end, and I would disagree with them about running back, but it's fair that they didn't have a position group below 18 on their list either. So, if you got the 10th most talented roster with the 6th easiest schedule, you should be a playoff team with a chance to make a deep playoff run. And I think we all believe that anyway.
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's like we all knew it, I think. We knew that they were going to have a weaker schedule and the rest of the division would have a stronger schedule and all that. But when you see it listed out like this and actually ranked, like the other three teams in the division have a top five schedule next year. The Bengals have a bottom six schedule next year. You got to feel pretty good about that because we're talking about the Bengals as being in the thick of the things and having the talent to be right up there at the top of the division and compete with Baltimore and Cleveland and Pittsburgh. So I don't know. It was just one of those things that kind of jumped out off the page when you saw it laid out there like that.
Yeah. And you get the NFC East, as you mentioned, the teams that ran down, and yes, that means Dallas on the road. And it means you're playing Philly, two really good teams, but you're also playing two stinkers in Washington and the Giants.
Yeah, exactly. Skinny, the Bengals have over $20 million left in cap space after the free agency signings over the last few weeks. Do you think that that's going to be put to use? Do you think there are any more moves on the horizon, or are we pretty much past that portion of the program?
I think a lot will depend on the draft. I still think they need cornerback depth, and I think they're either going to get that via the draft by moving maybe Dax Hill to corner, which I think is going to happen. We talked to him earlier this week. He's not been told what his role is going to be, and I think that's not going to be settled till the draft. That if they get somebody early enough in the draft, maybe his role is just to be a third safety. And to be groomed to replace Mike Hilton as the slot corner moving forward. And I do think unless they get a wide receiver that they feel can be a plug and play or at least compete for a starting spot, that they would probably go back to the free agency ranks to get a slot receiver. But I don't think they're going to use a ton of that $20 million. I think it'll probably be rolled over. And again, I warn people, when you see that cap number of the Bengals, slice it usually in half or even more than that, because they set aside some money for other things that, again, to somebody's point that's told me, said, you know, when you see this cap number, don't forget we have to pay for a whole roster. That doesn't really show. It shows the top 51 sometimes, doesn't account for practice squad, doesn't account for draft pick. There's a lot of things. So, again, don't get too over your skis that they didn't spend enough. I do think they'll use some of that. But, again, you got a big extension coming up for a certain wide receiver too. And, you know, maybe if there's enough there, maybe you do find a way to extend T. I don't think they will, but again, you can put some of that money to use if you so desire. So, yeah, I think they'll use it for something, depending on what comes out of the draft, again, for depth purposes or for competition purposes.
Who was your favorite signing of the free agency period by the Bengals?
It's a good question. I'm going to go Geno Stone, and maybe I'm wowed by just the 1 year he had playing on a really good defense, and maybe he was the beneficiary of being on a really good defense and he just had to do his small part. But I think he's a developing player. And I say that almost in the vein of Nick Scott was kind of that guy, it looked like too, where he finally got his chance to start, started all season for the Rams and came in here and threw in a clunker. The other one to me is the Shelby Rankins one is interesting depending on what else they can do on that defensive front in the draft. You know, can he play that role of pass rusher, or do you have to throw him into a different role as your nose tackle run stopper? And that's not what he was signed for, but is it what it's going to have to be? Because they really, if they messed up one place in this process of the offseason, it was not finding a nose tackle. And that's probably, again, the draft's going to have to fill that need, but it wasn't a very good market for that position group. You could argue that they should have made whatever offer to DJ Reader they could have. I think they made what they thought was a fair offer, and the agent said nope. We're going to take this one. I think they felt a little blindsided by that they thought they were doing right by him, and he ends up bolting. But either here or there, he's not here. So, yeah, I think they missed a little bit at that position group.
Interesting. So you gave two names there, and I would have gone with a third as my favorite signing. I would go with Trent Brown. I just think the fact that they haven't been deterred by going out and trying to get a few other high-priced big names through the free agency option here the last few years, and it hasn't necessarily worked out, right? Like Lael Collins was right. Pretty much a bust of a get, and yet they were still willing to each year go out and say, like, let's go get another big guy to protect Joe Burrow and make this offensive line as good as we possibly can. Not only that, but I also think Trent Brown might have the potential to be the best of the three big offensive linemen, big offensive tackles that they've added over the last 3 years. So I'm excited about that too.
Yeah, I think in a perfect world, if you draft, and that again, that this is going to go into where they draft somebody. Again, they're going to have so many choices at 18, and we'll talk more about that next week. And I'm breaking down each position group at local12.com. I'm on the what I call the Brock Bowers dilemma, the tight end position of what do you do if Brock Bowers is there, even though you are looking for a long-term right tackle and you're looking for defensive tackle help. Would it be impossible to pass on that guy as a talent? But back to the Trent Brown one, I'm kind of with you. My only thing is, if you do draft, let's just say one of those tackles falls to you at 18 and you take him and he just comes in and he wows you right away, Trent Brown is probably going to be the swing tackle. And so that signing, while I get it, it gave you at least a safety net where you don't have to go, we have to take a guy and we have to plug and play him and he has to play well or we're screwed. No, now you can see what the competition looks like. And if he's better, then he does play. If he still needs to develop, which a lot of tackles as rookies need to do. I mean, go look at Penei Sewell as a rookie to Penei Sewell today. I mean, the guy's what everybody hoped and expected him to be. He wasn't that guy as a rookie. He made mistakes. He had flaws. It happens. So yeah, I'm kind of with you on the Trent Brown one, cause it does give you peace of mind that, okay, even if let's just say you kick the tackle to the second round, a second round guy. Okay. He doesn't have to be a plug and play guy. We can spend a little time with him developing here.
Trent Brown is not going to be the swing tackle this year. I will put my money on that right now. Bet you anything you want. Trent Brown will be starting at tackle this year.
I would probably agree with that. But again,
regardless of the draft.
Yeah, that's probably right again, because you're a playoff caliber team that doesn't have to plug and play the rookie. It would be a luxury if you did it.
Right. And Joe Burrow is back there and he's been injured every damn year. And you're going to do everything in your power to make sure that doesn't happen again, including not putting a rookie out there to
correct. Protect. It is funny. People bring up all the injury stuff for Joe Burrow, but let's not forget one of those things that kept him out was an appendectomy. And another one was just him not getting hurt, him running and hurting his calf.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it's because of hits, but you're not going to take chances on him taking extra hits given that injury history. It's not like he's been fragile due to hits or he's been getting hit too much, although he has been getting hit too much. But you're not going to take any extra chances given his history. One last thing here on the Bengals, and it is on the draft. We'll talk more about this year's draft next week. We'll spend a lot of time on that, lead off the show with it. But the Athletic's Deontay Lee regraded last year's NFL draft, ended up giving the Bengals a D grade for last year. The write-up said the Bengals took three swings on defense to open the 2023 draft: Miles Murphy, DJ Turner, and Jordan Battle. And Turner looks most likely to grow into a full-time starter. Battle struggled to grasp the communication and play-to-play responsibilities of Cincinnati's defense. Murphy didn't make much of an impact, even as his participation increased. Skinny, do you agree with giving the Bengals a D for last year's draft based on what we know right now?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, but I would also say this: Miles Murphy was not expected to come in and bump off Sam Hubbard or Trey Hendrickson. And he did develop as the season went along. And I think that's all they were hoping he would do. DJ Turner, to his point, is going to be a starting corner this year. And I think he proved that. And to the point on Jordan Battle, he wasn't supposed to start last year. Nick Scott was so damn bad, they threw the kid into the mix. And I think Jordan had some good moments, but I think part of the thing of bringing Von Bell back is Von teaching him, here's how you do things in the NFL, kid. And I think it's gonna be Von and Geno Stone starting and Jordan back into a backup role. But if he's smart, he's going to learn from Von Bell the way you prepare, the way you do things, the way you communicate. I think that's as much of bringing Von Bell back here as anything else. So, yeah, for right now, I think that grade is fair. But I also think that grade can certainly improve vastly over the next couple of years.
I think that's all fans would want to hear, especially when you have a team that you feel like is a playoff caliber team. You understand that you might not always be drafting for immediate impact guys. Now, Bengals could have used some of them maybe last year the way the season unfolded, but I don't have a big problem with that either, as long as some of these guys develop, especially Miles Murphy. Any other thoughts on the Bengals, the draft, anything before we move on to Ask Any Anything?
No, to your point, I mean, we'll do more draft stuff next week. As I mentioned, at local12.com, each day I'm doing a position analysis. Some position analysis is the quarterback one took me about 20 minutes to do. That wasn't too hard to say, hey, they may be getting somebody in one of these last two rounds of the draft. So some other position groups are harder. The wide receiver one, they're going to, if they choose to get a wide receiver in the second to fourth round, they're going to get a good one because there's a lot of them graded in that round that can come in and play and help this team.
All right, perfect. Well, we'll talk more about that on next week's show. We'll probably do that Wednesday if you are trying to plan your schedule around the Skinny Podcast. I know all of you do.
Oh, yeah, everybody does.
Yeah. Let's get into Ask Skinny Anything. We'll start with this one. Heard this golf hypothetical last week and immediately thought of Skinny. You play every major for the next 10 years. The catch is you start 100 yards out on every hole. So you're going to play every major. You get to start 100 yards out from the hole on every hole. How many wins would you end up with?
I'd still end up with none. I'd still end up with none.
Really?
I would say that for most tour players, 100 yards in, their scoring average, including the 100-yard shot, would be probably 2.2 to 2.3. They'll put it close enough almost every time, most times, and make more putts than they probably miss from the distance. That for me, I'd be happy to get down in three, and more times than not, I'd probably get down in four or five because I'd be 30 feet away with a downhill putt. Cause I won't leave it in the right spot on the hole like these guys. I know where to put it. I won't be able to put it there. I'll be above the hole on a hole and end up four jacking it. So trust me, it's a great question. I love the question, but I'd love to try to get down 100 yards in on some of those Masters holes. With the undulation and really see how hard it would be to do that.
Yeah. I mean, like what do you think you would shoot on? I mean, what, take any major event, whatever course you want. What do you think you would shoot if you start out 100 yards out on every hole?
Probably 75-ish.
So, you know, I'm not a golfer at all. I'll play in a charity event or two per year. I don't know these courses. Like, how different is it for you to play Kenton County versus to play whatever, you know, St. Andrews?
It would be impossible. I've never been. I'm going to use Augusta as the one.
Okay.
People cannot appreciate it. And I know this is going to feel like name dropping. I promise you it's not. I didn't realize this. I'm really not name dropping. I'm just the fact that I was there last year. You just don't have an appreciation on TV for the undulations of those greens. You don't. You think you do. I always thought I did until I walked around like, good Lord Almighty, how do you even putt from there? One of the shortest holes on the – well, it's not a short hole. It's a short par four. Number four is a 350-yard hole, which for most tour players, that sounds easy, right? That sounds like blasting one down there, a little flip up, and you more times than not make a birdie. Well, the undulation of that is so much that a lot of players complain that they can't make birdies there. And I can't remember who it was. I guess it was Sam or I can't. It might have been Bobby Jones who said it to somebody at a dinner way, but long time ago. He helped build Augusta. Who said it's impossible to make a birdie? How is it that we can't make a birdie at this short par four? And he turned around after overhearing this and said it wasn't designed for you to make birdie. It was designed for you to make par. And that's just the undulation of that hole. When they put the pins in certain places, if you're above it, you have no chance whatsoever. None. Especially a rank amateur 15 handicap like myself.
What's the best golf course you've ever played?
Southern Hills Country Club in Tulsa, Oklahoma with a friend when I lived there. I was little. I was 10 years old. I don't remember a ton of it, but they held the PGA Championship there before, maybe even the US Open there before. I don't really remember. Probably the best one, I played Firestone up in Akron once with a guy and that was ridiculous. And they obviously hold, you know, tournaments there too.
I'm sorry. I should have rephrased that question to be a golf guy question, which is the best track you've ever played at.
Thank you. My bad. Tracks for that and pitches for soccer.
Yeah. Favorite Patrick Swayze movie. And what did you think of the Roadhouse remake with McGregor?
I've not seen the Roadhouse remake. I do like Roadhouse. It's so corny, campy. It's good. Kelly Lynch is a smoke show. But to me, it's still Red Dawn. Red Dawn or The Outsiders? The thing about The Outsiders is he doesn't have a huge role in The Outsiders. He plays the older – have you seen The Outsiders?
No.
The original?
No.
It's one of my favorites. You talk about a star-studded cast. My Lord, Ralph Macchio, Patrick Swayze, Tom Cruise, Emilio Estevez. I mean, it is a ridiculous cast that's in that movie. Diane Lane's in it. I mean, it's just a ridiculous cast. But yeah, Red Dawn's pretty good. He plays a great role in that too.
Emilio Estevez, the Mighty Ducks man.
Notice I didn't say what was the one where don't put baby in the corner. Dirty Dancing.
Dirty Dancing. Yeah, not your movie.
No, I
guarantee you've watched that with the daughters a time or two, though.
I've watched it, sure. Yeah. I know the line, the famous line, nobody puts baby in a corner, but I mean, you know.
Yep. All right, we're going to move on to this one. This is asked by a few different people, sent us links and everything, got the video for it. This was at the Indiana Fever, I believe, the introductory press conference.
Oh, I know of this. It's funny you say that. I've heard everything about it. I've not seen this yet. I know the guy who asked the question. We both do. But go ahead.
Yeah, this is Caitlin Clark's introductory press conference.
I got to see this.
Greg Doyle is a columnist for the Indy Star. He used to be a radio guy here in Cincinnati, I believe, is how he got his start.
Yeah, he was a columnist for CBSSports.com, who used to have the greatest mailbag column of all time.
Before Cincinnati?
Before Cincinnati. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes. Oh, he was terrific. His mailbag column was outstanding because people would ask him questions, ripping him, and he'd rip them right back with facts. He'd always have one where somehow a bot would ask him a question. You know, it was just so
did he
clever.
Do something with Mo on air?
Yeah. In fact, okay. when they kind of changed things over when Tom and I got moved out of the – Tom moved to Sports Talk, and I was doing it by myself, and I got riffed, which neither here nor there. They kind of changed their lineup around a little bit, and they made Mo and Greg a two-person show. It didn't work to some degree because, to me, you got to have a straight man with a funny man, and they both were the funny man. And Greg was just so – he's so talented. He really is. He's a talented writer. He was talented in that format, but it was just almost so over the top that he did alienate. You know, like people say Tracy Jones alienates them when he – no, they don't. You listen to him because he's just a goof. Same with Bill Cunningham. You hate him, but you listen. The ratings prove that kind of stuff. But Greg was a little bit too much. But yeah. Greg's a nut. But, man, he is a talented, talented writer.
He's a tormented guy. I think he's been pretty open about that. He's had his own mental health issues, and that's come out at different times throughout his career.
So I've been so busy today, and I was so busy yesterday. I've heard about this. The text chain group I'm in with a bunch of writer friends have talked about it. I still have not seen it, so I'm interested in this.
All right, so here is the video. If you're watching on YouTube, hopefully you can hear it on the podcast as well. This is Greg Doyle asking questions at the Caitlin Clark press conference. The first question is to Caitlin Clark herself. The second question is to the coach of the Indiana Fever.
You like that?
Hold on. Let me rewind you here.
I like that. Hi, Caitlin. Greg Doyle, Indy Star. Real quick, let me do this.
He's making a heart.
You like that?
I like that you're here. That you're here.
I do that at my family after every game, so.
Okay, well, let's start doing it to me, and we'll get along just fine. So, question is, Star, hi.
This is the second question.
You just were given the keys to that. What are you going to do with it?
What am I going to do with them? Hopefully we're going to win a lot of games to start. She's going to help us out with that.
All right. So this blew up, went super viral online. Greg Doyle is getting absolutely crushed. Everyone called it creepy. Everyone said, like, men don't know how to talk to young women. This is going to be a disaster with female sports becoming more popular and all this stuff. All these men are going to get exposed. Skinny, what'd you think of Greg Doyle's situation there? Is he a creep? That's the question we got asked. Is Greg Doyle a creep?
I don't think so. I think to his point, I think for him, he's one of the last of the great local columnists. And I mean that in his city, he is just outstanding. I think what he meant by it was her being there is going to help him in his job and for subscribers and all the things that he needs. I don't think it was anything other than that. It may have come off creepy with the heart thing. It's something I know she said she does. And then his writing style is kind of that last question he asked the coach, what are you going to do given the keys to that? And there's nothing wrong, because if that's the way you're going to write it, you want a genuine answer to that, right? I mean, you want the answer you're looking for to that. So it's just him, man. I get it. I get why people may feel that way. It's just him.
This is obviously weird. It's a weird question, interaction, press conference. I'm not trying to downplay that. He is a weird dude, and this was as weird as it gets. If I'm a young girl, if I'm Caitlin Clark in that situation, I would do exactly what she did and stare right back at him like, what are you doing, dude? Yes. Like, that is very strange. That being said, we are like so far gone with this wanting to blow up and cancel everybody and fire them. And they're like a sexual predator or something because they made a heart at someone. Like, it's weird. And I would even, I'll be honest, I'm surprised something like this hasn't happened with Rose Lavelle and all of our old men media guys. Cause I'll tell you right now, you old, not you personally, but the other old dudes around us that will come to like, come up to us and be like, oh, Rose Lavelle. I just love her. I've got the biggest crush on Rose Lavelle. And they know who they are. Like, they've come up to me and do it at Xavier Press, at Xavier's media room. I think you guys are weird when you guys do that personally. Like, that is a weird interaction to have with like an athlete you're covering and being like, oh, I've got a crush on her and stuff. And she's 30 years younger than you. I do think some older guys who are covering these sports are probably going to have a weird time with that. Like, they should probably realize that that's not going to be an appropriate way to approach interviewing someone. I don't know if that's what Greg was doing here or not.
I don't either. Again, I think his point to it was, A, I do think he likes women's sports. And if you do, I would like her to be in my town that I'm covering too, to see her play and to cover her. Yeah. And I think, again, just from the perspective of the interest she's going to draw, is going to draw more eyeballs to what you write. You're going to write about her a lot. You're going to write about the team a lot more than you've ever thought about writing about them. And so it's a win for him. I think that's truly what he meant by that. I honestly mean that. I'm not trying to be naive here by any stretch.
Maybe that. I also think he's a guy who thinks he's very funny. He thinks he's whimsical and goofy and funny, and he's old now. So being whimsical and goofy and funny, a lot of times is going to miss the mark when you're just an old guy who's kind of corny and really not that funny anymore. And so he's trying to do something out there that he thinks is going to be like a funny moment. And it's like, actually, dude, that just came off as weird and creepy. But I don't think his intent was like, I'm actually hitting on Caitlin Clark or something right here. And I don't.
Yeah, and I was there backlash over that second question he asked to the coach?
Yeah, just referring to as you just got the after you do the heart thing and you're making gaga eyes at her and be like, oh, if you do that to me, we'll just be just fine. Then to follow it up with, you just got the keys to that is like, it's an uncomfortable way to put it. I think people are just like, you're sort of objectifying this girl who's up there. And whether that's fair or not, I don't know. But I do think it was a weird way to phrase it. But I'll be like, these people who are freaking out about this have clearly never been to a Paul Daugherty press conference before. It's like he does this 10 times a week. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, the phraseology, maybe you're right. You're not humanizing that. But again, if you're looking for a specific answer, because that coach, I can you imagine when she's been sitting there knowing they have the number one pick the whole time, knowing that it's going to be Caitlin Clark probably since the whole college season or since the WNBA season ended, you did get the keys to that. And that's a pretty special player. And I would be excited by that. So I think the phraseology of it, it doesn't bother me. Again, if you're trying to get an emotional answer, and she gave a pretty vanilla answer, but okay. I think
everyone was weirded out by Greg Doyle at that point. So then when he asked that second question that way, it was just like, this guy has lost it. It's like, why not just ask the question as you just got the most transformative player, transcendent player in women's college sports or women's sports period. What is that going to mean to your franchise? What are you going to do with her or something? Like, instead of saying that while you're looking right at Caitlin Clark, it's kind of weird. Which Cincinnati sports personality from the past do you most wish would have been around for the social media era, Skinny? This is our last question.
He's still around. Boomer was always a good quote. I can imagine he would be popping off someone on social media.
Chris Collinsworth used to talk about running around with $100 bills hanging out of his pants. Would that have been good for him to be in social media limelight?
I think he would have been a social media guy too. I'm trying to think if anybody on the Big Red Machine would have been. I can't see Pete or Joe Morgan or Johnny Bench is actually pretty active on social media, believe it or not. You know, maybe
I feel like that's not real interesting, right? No, he's just like a nice guy.
Yeah.
Would Eric Davis have been good?
Yeah, I always like talking to Eric. I don't know. I don't think he'd have
nothing
been
crazy.
Tracy Jones
would have been a good one.
I mean,
Chad Johnson was around for social media, but it was a little bit different at the time. He was kind of like, he was blowing up before it really got big. He would be he would have been a monster now.
But obviously he's very active in it, as we know.
Yeah. He would be a monster now. If social media was now what it is now, he would be so famous.
I would agree with that. Especially with these guys that are getting Instagram endorsement stuff. I mean, he would have had a cottage industry doing that.
He was doing live streaming during training camp back before anyone knew what live streaming like really was at the time. I don't know what he was even doing that on, but if like Twitch was around and as popular back then, he would have been massive on something like that or even YouTube Live. I feel like we're missing some really good names here, but nothing's coming to me that would be like obvious.
Yeah, nobody's coming to me obviously as well either. I'm racking my brain through the 70s and 80s in that group, and nobody pops into my head.
Is there a coach that maybe we're missing here?
Hugs wouldn't have been on social media by any chance. There's no chance.
No.
Sam Weish
would have been an interesting one, maybe.
You know, he would have been.
Would he have fired off some tweets?
I think he might have. I honestly think he might have.
Yeah, this feels like such a good question, but it does. Also feels like we're missing obvious answers.
So I hope the person that asked this question watches this and had somebody in mind that we didn't name, and I'd like to hear what they would if they had, because I'm going to guess they had somebody in mind when they asked this question, right?
Yeah, like I can think of fun ones. Like Icky Woods probably would have been a fun guy to have for social media. Probably would have gotten some cool videos or something of him dancing back in the day. Like the team, if there was like the Bengals social media team around back then, they would have done some fun stuff with a guy like Icky Woods, maybe. But I can't think of anyone who, like, reading their takes or their emotional tweets after a game would be that great. I'm drawing a blank on that.
Yeah, I am too. So again, the person who asked this question is watching this and they wanted a specific answer. I'd love to hear the name.
Yeah, and all of you guys who are out there listening and screaming names into your car as you listen to us flub them, go ahead. Chime in on Twitter or email or wherever else you hit us up typically. That's all we got, Skinny.
All right, good stuff. Appreciate it. We'll be back next week. We're going to preview the NFL draft and more. Reds will have another week of games under their belt and probably some more transfer portal news on top of it all. For Rick Roaring, I'm Richard Skinner. It's been the Skinny Podcast, the weekly Bo Green edition presented by Blake, the Attorney Mason.